in the meantime, it's my great honor to introduce Renate Loll. She has a tight connection to PI, being a distinguished visiting research fellow. Chair. and she was actually, I mean, this means that you don't have to do much, but she had a very work-intensive job also at PI, namely being chair of the SAC for a long time. Renate studied in Freiburg at the London School of Economics and at Imperial, where she also did her PhD on BST quantization. Then she had a number of postdocs in Bonn, Syracuse, and Penn State, and in Florence. And she was one of the first looking into loop quantum gravity as lattice gravity, and she wrote a review on lattice gravity, which is the reference today. So if you want to know anything about lattice gravity, read her living review on living reviews on general relativity. Then she was a Heisenberg Fellow at the Albert Einstein Institute in Potsdam and moved as a professor to Utrecht, where she built up a group. And she repeated this exercise at Radboud University in Nijmegen, where she built an even bigger group. And she's today best known for inventing and constructing the causal dynamical triangulation approach. And that turned out to be a highly successful way to define the gravitational path integral on the non-perturbative lattice in a non-perturbative way, curing lots of problems of previous approaches. And that will be the subject of your talk. Thank you.
Okay, thanks.
Good. Let me start in pink mode. now, thank you to Bianca for, I think that was about the most accurate introduction I've received in a talk. That's always very gratifying. Thank you also. Thanks to the awesome three who are organizing this conference. And there's some more in the background, of course. Welcome the late arrivals. You're just on time. So what I'm going to talk about is, of course, quantum space-time, this being the topic of the conference. So what's the context? The context was basically given to you by Bianca. So I'm interested in quantum gravity beyond perturbation theory. And I'm working on a research program which is of causal and angular triangulations, or CDT for short. Although there are quite a few people in the audience who are experts, there are also some who are simply not. So I'll keep this in mind. I was trying in preparing this talk to take a somewhat broader perspective on some of the issues that this approach has helped to bring to the fore, but which I believe are relevant to quantum gravity more generally. So what I'll be talking about are the following things. Well, obviously quantum space-time. So where does it come from and where are we heading? Then I'll advocate a new concept of fundamental continuity and say something about the hidden power of ratchet calculus, which you may not have been aware of until now. Now, as a homage to Noether, of course, I'll be talking about symmetry and diffeomorphisms, which is an important theme in gravity and quantum gravity. And lastly, I talk about a set of non-perturbative, scale-dependent observables to hopefully help us understand what quantum space-time is about. Okay, so what is quantum space-time? Well, obviously, we turn to Google for an answer, but well, now we see, unfortunately, this very pink shaded versions of quantum space-time here for the occasion. So they're much prettier than what you can see here. But what they have in common is that most of them are, well apart from a couple, this one here and that one here, who actually come from simulations of two-dimensional toy models of quantum gravity, well, they are artistic impressions of kind of what we believe happens to space-time when we go to very short distances. So what they have in common is, well, things are certainly no longer smooth, and, well, they may develop you know, wormholes and worse. So, you know, that's the image, the hand-waving image that people have of space-time. They say, well, if you go to all the way to the Planck scale, that means the gravitational field itself will quantum fluctuate. So G mu nu, I won't be able to recognize smooth G mu nus, but, you know, something else will take that place, something that's a more ill-behaved, and then we call this quantum foam or space-time foam. Now, so what is a space-time? Well, a space-time is usually taken to be a space with some kind of metric properties, but which is kind of quantum fluctuating near the Planck length, the scale set by the Planck length, but which in a suitable coarse-grained macroscopic limit can be approximated by something we can recognize as a solution to the classical Einstein equations. Now, let me be more specific, because people talk about, you know, non-classical spacetimes or spacetimes beyond classical geometry in all kinds of contexts. Think, for instance, of non-commutative geometry. So what I'm after here is something more specific, namely a quantum spacetime that comes out or emerges as a solution to a certain dynamics from a theory I want to call quantum gravity. Yeah. So quantum gravity describes the dynamics of some kind of degrees of freedom at the Planck scale. So let me just call that quantum gravity. And we are interested kind of in the states or the quantum states such a system can assume. Let's take pure gravity. So we would call those quantum spacetimes. And even more specific, what is often interested, at least in the first instance, is some kind of ground state of that theory. So I call this a vacuum, or really the mother of all vacua, where we have also included the dynamical degrees of freedom of space-time itself. Yeah. So often, when I talk about quantum space-time, I will mean kind of such a vacuum. Now, as far as we know, this requires going beyond perturbation theory. So it suddenly appears that something like, you know, empty Minkowski space is not a very good candidate for this vacuum. But of course, there is no single way we have agreed upon about how to proceed in quantum gravity. And so to just, you know, as a reminder to ourselves, and just to clarify a little this a little bit to people who are not so familiar with the subject. So how do different candidate theories of quantum gravity differ? Well, they tend to differ in their choice of what are, I mean, certain a priori choices, namely those of kind of elementary degrees of freedom the theory has, some kind of dynamical principle, so you could very loosely call this kind of quantum Einstein equations, and by how much background structure they use. So that means whether metric degrees of freedom, maybe differentiable structure, manifold structure, topology, dimension, etc., are fixed or are part of dynamics. Yeah. So where I think it's a priori clear that not everything can be dynamic, so you have to hold, you know, some things have to be fixed because you want to still have a well-defined dynamical system that you're describing with more or less standard tools. So, of course, and you can have extra structures and assumptions on top of those of the classical theory. And of course, there's a wide variety of things you may do. You may add symmetries, you know, sort of supersymmetry. You may add dimensions, you may make certain specific choices for a set of variables that you would like to be have nicely represented in the quantum theory, et cetera, et cetera. So I'll be very brief in just stating. So in CDT, one makes choices that are kind of simple, but not too simple. So almost minimalist, but not so minimalist that you cannot get anywhere. But I may or may not come back to this point, depending on how much time I have. So let's start, you know, with some also things that we are often implicitly assuming to be the case in order for this entire adventure to make sense. So what we are assuming when we work on kind of non-perturbative quantum gravity is that there is indeed a meaningful way to talk in terms of, you know, the tools of theoretical physics about some, you know, formulating quantitative models of what happens at, in inverted commas, as a Planck scale. So that this is really a meaningful enterprise. It's not a priori clear that such a description should exist, given the kind of ridiculous smallness of the Planck scale. So, and we are also assuming not only this, but that there is an associated with this Planckian dynamics, there is some kind of phenomenology that at least in principle allows me to predict certain phenomena that do not just follow from the classical or, you know, perturbative quantum theory, but which are kind of genuine quantum signatures, which, you know, be it through, you know, very, very clever experiments or some, say, astrophysical observation, I will be able to detect. Yeah. So if I'm not making these assumptions, I don't really know why I should start, or, you know, of course, I could just have quantum gravity as a hobby. So another thing I think is quite essential, there's, of course, a criticism leveled often at something like string theory, that it is vastly non-unique. So there we should be careful not to, you know, trap into kind of the same situation by making sure that we find a framework, either by arguing in terms of symmetries or naturalness or just the way we set things up, that the quantum gravity theory we are getting is kind of reasonably unique. So by this I mean, well, I just have a handful of parameters that I may have to need and to adjust coming from, you know, certain measurements, but that's it. So it's reasonably unique, and I don't have, you know, vast parameter spaces which don't allow me in the end to make any kind of predictions. So in your favorite approach, you better tell me, us, so what ensures uniqueness or what ensures kind of universality properties, that means independence of certain, you know, properties of your regulator that I often need to adopt in order to make calculations meaningful at some intermediate stage. Now, of course, looking at a picture like this, right, I'm zooming into some little piece of empty space-time, then once my microscope reaches the Planck scale, it's all becoming extremely wiggly and non-classical. So one says, okay, going beyond classicality, oh, and we are quantum. Well, what is more natural than to believe that quantum, that space-time itself would kind of be fundamentally discrete at the Planck scale? So this is actually, I think, maybe even a prevailing view in our community. I've never really understood the deeper logic, or I have never been really convinced at the arguments that were put forward. Of course, let alone that one would need to define what an operational meaning of this is. I think entire, you know, discussion sessions at quantum gravity conferences have been about the pros and cons of fundamental discreteness and what this is supposed to mean and why this is so natural, etc. So, but I think that leads us down a quite complicated road, for want of a better word. So I have an alternative suggestion, which would be to say, well, it's not really fundamental discreteness that gets us where we want to go, but it's something milder, which I call fundamental continuity. So, of course, you can have spaces with metric properties that are not smooth, but are continuous. But they're not discrete in the sense of, I mean, discrete spaces, I mean, bunches of points or something, you know, like you would assume when you work on causal sets, say. So it's somewhere in between, and I want to argue in what follows that this is a very fruitful avenue to go down. And of course, the prime example of that is something like ratchet calculus, where you're substituting smooth curved space-times by piecewise flat objects. And I will say more about those in what follows. So here, this is our idea. Here is my standard manifold picture. And I'm substituting these curved objects, which I describe, you know, using coordinate systems, nice patches I grab from R4 or Rn in general. And I substitute these by kind of piecewise flat objects, which I can think of as triangulated spaces, which are kind of glued together. I mean, there can still be manifolds, I mean, locally of a certain dimension, which are glued together also to get metric spaces. So why is this natural? I would say, in some sense, this is entirely standard in quantum theory. If you're thinking of something like, you know, what type of path contribute with measure one to the path integral of a non-relativistic particle moving in a potential, it's those paths that are, well, actually nowhere differentiable. Yeah. So but they're still continuous. So here, that would be a natural analog, but of course, it is slightly more radical because we're not talking about this non-smooth object that are embedded, but in some space-time that's given to me a priori and has nice properties, but we're talking about space-time itself. Yeah, but nevertheless, it's not an unnatural choice. So as I said before, it's certainly much less radical than fundamental discretes, and in particular, it's still relatively easy to do actual computations, which of course is helpful. Now, and there is an additional bonus, which I'll zoom in on my next slide, that is this ratchet calculus that's all about kind of doing kind of gravity with these piecewise flat spaces, apart from being a convenient way to regularize the theory, so to make certain expressions, I mean, like the path integral, finite. Yeah, it also has this additional bonus that it does not use any coordinates. And therefore, it treats kind of the diffeomorphism symmetry of the classical smooth objects in a different way, and in a much more for the quantum theory, much more convenient way. So while classically, this is kind of just a feature and doesn't really do too much for you, this absence of coordinates, I will argue that its full power becomes apparent in non-perturbative quantum gravity, and in particular, a kind of a path integral approach that one is following in CDT. So here we are at classical space-time, the way we learn it from our textbooks in general relativity, or in case of more senior people like me, the way we teach it to our students. So here's again this picture of the differential manifold with local coordinate chart. And these are, of course, extremely powerful models of space-time. And not just powerful, they're beautiful. Right? People often argue classical GR is kind of the most beautiful classical theory we have. It's all about geometry. Geometric properties get encoded in taking second derivatives of some smooth or at least twice differentiable function g mu of x. So then you get the Riemann curvature tensor, and then you know everything you would ever have wanted to know about such a curved space. Now, this description comes with an enormous redundancy, which is this freedom to choose coordinates in whichever way I like to describe one and the same physics. So in the classical theory, that's often thought as an advantage, namely my ability to choose coordinates in a convenient way that's adapted to my problem, and therefore kind of try and simplify my equations. But in the quantum theory, it's nothing but a kind of pain in the neck. So it means GR as a field theory has a kind of an infinite dimensional invariance group. And of course, I have the usual problems when I go to the quantum theory that I want to fix these gauge degrees of freedom. I really only want to talk about the physical degrees of freedom, but of course, they're not neatly divided between kind of gauge diffeomorphism degrees of freedom and the physical degrees of freedom. I mean, if you're talking perturbatively or kind of the gravitons. Yeah. So, and I would contend that two key challenges of quantum gravity are how to implement the symmetry in the quantum theory and how to describe then physics in terms of things that are just diffeomorphism invariant, so so-called quantum observables. Okay, so let's go to ratchet calculus. So a very brief reminder of what this is. So what I'm considering is an approximation of smooth curved spacetimes. The approximation is very nice because it's very universal. It works in any dimension. It works for any signature. So it works Lorentzian, Euclidean, or whatever other exotic signature you may have in mind. So it substitutes kind of the degrees of freedom of some differentiable manifold M with a smooth metric assignment in terms of a symmetric metric tensor G mu nu in terms of data, well, that are consist of T. So T is a so-called Simplicial manifold. Let me translate it. It's a triangulated manifold. So it's still locally the manifold. So it's topologically, say, four-dimensional locally. Together with edge length assignments I attach to the edges of all these triangular building blocks. So the whole in D dimensions, this object you can think of as being glued together from D-dimensional simplices, which are simply d-dimensional generalizations of triangles. Yeah? So in a simple example like here, I'm in two dimensions. These are individual triangles. What I have to give you are all the Li squareds. Yeah, these are kind of the, yeah, they contain metric information. Yeah? And I have to be careful that I satisfy triangular equalities. Otherwise, I don't have a triangulation that can be realized with edge lengths. But on the other hand, so why am I using the squares? To be able to choose these space-like, light-like, or time-like. So I have these options, all of those options. And the thing is, if I fix edge lengths of a single triangle and I demand it to be flat on the interior, that completely fixes all geometric properties of these triangles individually. So let's see, also if you are in Minkowski space, just giving the length here on the sides will fix exactly where the light cones are. Yeah. So this is very nice. So I pay attention. I pay attention to the triangle equalities, and I make these line assignments, these assignments. And so what I have to give to you in total, I have to give you all the edge lengths of all the triangles, the number of gluing them together pairwise, so the side lengths match, or whatever is the analog in higher dimensions. And then I have to give you a list of who is glued to whom. I can give you, you know, a big kind of connectivity matrix to do this. So with these data, yeah, all the geometric properties of such an object are captured. And that's nice because for a finite number of building blocks, that's just a finite list of data. And with this, I then try and do my computations. So in the context of gravity, this was really introduced by in 1961 by Tullio Regge in a paper with a very descriptive title, General Relativity Without Coordinates. Because note there are no coordinates I've introduced anywhere on these triangles. All I've given you are these kind of geodesic edge lengths. So that's all. So what one then also can do is to rewrite, say, the Einstein-Hilbert action, if you're now thinking of using that in gravity, by kind of the Regge version of the action. And that's just a prescription, basically, of introducing all the geometric degrees of freedom, angles, volumes, etc., as a function of these Li squareds for a given geometry. So I can just rewrite everything in terms of these length variables. So how is curvature captured? Well, the easiest way here is illustrated by this picture from two dimensions, and it's in terms of the so-called deficit angle. Yeah, so imagine a simple situation where I'm in 2D and I just work with equilateral triangles. Yeah, and then let me glue five of them at a common vertex. Then I know that if I add up the angles here that sit around this vertex, it will not add up to 2 pi, but there will be a pi third missing. And that's the so-called deficit angle I've written down here. Yeah, so if I would cut this open and put it flat on the table, it would be completely obvious that this is missing, this deficit angle. And this is a direct measure for the Gaussian curvature that is located here at this red dot, this vertex. Yeah? So local curvature in a kind of a finite triangulation of this type appears via this deficit angle assignments. So this is a very old idea from the 60s. And people picked that up at later stages, at various times. So in the first place, it was meant to be a calculational tool for classical Einstein gravity. So let's say just finding solutions in some, you know, numerical scheme for the classical Einstein equations. So, and it was, I mean, various people, including in this room, Raphael and collaborators, but as well as others, tried to just set up classical evolution schemes using these Regge type variables. So in four dimensions here, this is a typical building block. So with here space-like and time-like edges, of course, you can make many different choices for those. So it was also looked then at as a natural building block to do quantum gravity with it. So in the early 80s, that started with kind of investigating, well, do I recover kind of insuitable limits from such a lattice description? Gravity, the degrees of freedom of gravity, and there was some groundbreaking work by Martin Rotschek and Ruth Williams, who rederived the propagator in some flat space limit around and for weak fields. Yeah. of course, in this process, one kind of has to reintroduce all kind of the baggage of usual gravity, that is coordinates and making gauge choices. Yeah. So, but this kind of works out in more recent times. Bianca, who is sitting here, has in especially in three, but also in four dimensions, investigated kind of how does one recover kind of diffeomorphism symmetry again in kind of typically in a linearized context from such geometries. So, so one thing to be said is, of course, you have to keep in mind that Ragic calculus doesn't have any distinguished status. I mean, it's not a fundamental theory of gravity. It's just an approximation to classical gravity. And as such, it is hugely non-unique. So why is it non-unique? Well, of course, you know, these are finite size building blocks. And really, in order to say something about continuum physics, I have to perform some kind of limit. Yeah? So I have to perform some limit in the classical theory where these triangulated objects approach some given classical space-time as well as possible. And people have, of course, discussed in the classical context convergence issues that must be considered. So I'm talking especially about Leo Bruin, Adrian Gentle, and various other people. Now, when we come kind of to the use of these objects in a non-perturbative quantum theory, then this is really very different. Also with respect to what do we want to approximate, we, in that case, do not want to approximate a specific geometry. So that would be semi-classical or classical thinking. But what we want to do is we want to approximate the configuration space we are integrating over when we do the path integral. So we want to have a nice approximation of that space, and that is a totally different, well, involves a totally different kind of topology on the space of all metric spaces than it does in these classical applications. So there are basically, to cut a long story short, two ways of proceeding, which I've noted down here. The first one is the one that was pursued earlier, is kind of quantum Ragic calculus. So what one does, one fixes a given connectivity of these triangulated lattice and then allows the edge lengths to vary. Yeah, and so therefore integrates over all possible edge lengths subject to triangle inequalities. So that was followed in the mid-80s by Berg and also by Humber and Williams later. So there is a kind of complementary approach that was developed a little bit later, which is that of dynamical triangulations, where one fixes the edge lengths. And let's say if I wanted to leave myself the opportunity to discuss space and time like edges, I would maybe allow them to have two different types of edge lengths in terms of a fundamental UV cutoff, which I call A. And I then sum over all ways to glue these together to get simplicial manifolds. So there are kind of two complementary ways to integrate over degrees of freedom in the path integral associated with such a Ragic geometry. So and here's the people who were first doing this work based on earlier work in lower dimensions, where Angstein Migdal and Ambion and Yukievich in the early 90s. So I won't say very much about this, apart from highlighting some of the properties of A. So because of these triangle inequalities, not even in two dimensions one can do any kind of analytical computations in that framework, which hampers one somewhat. There's also an issue about residual gauge symmetry that appears here, namely manipulations of the edge lengths that leaves the action invariant, and what is their interpretation? Then there's a question of the measure. One thing that was very prominently discussed back in the 80s and 90s is that this approach does not recover two-dimensional Liouville gravity, which of course is a continuum formulation where you gauge fix the gravitational path integral. However, this approach does. So people from that community said, well, something must be wrong here. I don't think any of these arguments are really, cannot be overcome. So that might be still a very worthwhile approach for quantum gravity. However, one thing that we have learned since those days is there might be a problem with the fact that this here is a kind of purely Euclidean approach. That is, in four dimensions, where you cannot do analytical work, where you are reliant on Monte Carlo simulations to understand the properties of these as dynamical systems, you need them to be kind of real partition functions with Boltzmann weights instead of complex valued path integrals. And in that, yeah, so this is only ever a path integral for purely Euclidean. Whereas this, we have now a causal version or a Lorentzian version that has taken us much further. So this might be just one kind of unassailable advantage of the second way of doing it with dynamical triangulations. So I'll make this very brief, but let me tell you therefore what is a key motivation for working with these dynamical triangulations, but not only those, but with a causal version, a Lorentzian version of those. So what we've learned about kind of the pathologies of these Euclidean path integrals comes not from looking at them on paper, because they just look just as nice as the path integral for another signature, but generally performing them, trying to understand their dynamics with the help of computers. And there it turns out they very generically suffer from certain pathologies, that go under the name of kind of branched polymer degeneracies, which seem to be very generic and not really tied to any particular model. And currently, the only known cure to not run into these pathologies, which seem to be associated with the absence of a nice classical limit of these models, is really causal dynamical triangulations. So that uses the Reggie idea, so it's kind of manifestly diffeomorphism invariant in this sense. It's not background independent, and it is a non-perturbative path integral, where I now require by hand, I put in a condition that the light cone structure must be nice everywhere, so well behaved. So I told you earlier, my building blocks, when I give you edge lengths, I know where the light cones are. So my gluing rules are now such that I require them to be glued together in a meaningful way, that these configurations are put into the path integral, they have a well-defined causal structure. So no, this is not the same as saying causality. I mean, causality is a property of matter that behaves, how matter behaves on a given space with a causal structure. No, this is kind of one step back, more elementary. And you could say it's an experimental finding that one seems to need to put in causality in order for these ensembles to have a chance of lead to kind of emergent four-dimensional extended geometry. So there are also no models known in any dimension kind of where such a causal structure emerges. So where you just start out with Euclidean types of space times, you take the path integral, and then by magic, kind of, you know, a time flow emerges or light cone structure emerges. Well, it doesn't mean there is no such thing, but like with many things we'd love to emerge, it's more difficult in practice than it is in theory or wishful thinking. So also a note of caution, sometimes people say, oh, you're fixing the causal structure, but that's of course not true, because the causal structure is just part of the metric degrees of freedom that are encoded in these Reggie geometries. And of course it quantum fluctuates, and quantum fluctuates even very strongly on short distances. So this goes to say these arguments that, you know, probably, but who knows, there are always loopholes in quantum gravity, the Euclidean path integral may not be quite good enough. And also as a side remark, gravity put on the lattice, that's one way, of course, to think about this CDT stuff, does not necessarily imply a breaking of diffeomorphism invariance. So this is very briefly such the one slide where I flash at you the explicit expression of the path integral. I mean, you know, it's beauty only apparent to the person, you know, persons who work with this on a daily basis. This is, of course, this very nice looking, but misleadingly nice looking, very formal path integral for gravity, for pure gravity, where I'm integrating just over all space times, weighted by, you know, some complex weights with the Einstein-Hilbert action in them, including here a cosmological constant term. Now, I put this on a firm footing in CDT by giving very specific prescriptions for what are all these ingredients for the measure, the sum, the configuration space I'm summing over, in order to make this a well-defined object, which I then study in a limit as I remove all the regulators. Yeah, so this is really just standard QFT way of proceeding. The regulators are a UV cutoff, so I let the size of these building blocks shrink to zero, why I take them to be a very large number. Yes, there was a question?
What kind of boundary conditions do we consider for this?
Yeah, so I have suppressed them in those here. Whatever you want. I mean, what we typically do, of course, we are on the computer, so we choose things to be spatially compact, and we typically we identify them cyclically in time. And the spatial topologies that have been studied extensively are the three sphere and the three torus. But I won't be saying very much about these things because that would take me far too far down the road of what this is all about. So it's suffice it to say, so we are looking for continuum limits, scaling limits, which in general will also need a renormalization of the bare couplings that appear in this object. There is no residual gauge symmetry, and this path integral also obeys reflection positivity, which is a very nice thing to do. So this approach has not been dreamt up yesterday, and I have only 5 more minutes to go into this. So please, your bedtime reading is either this old review from 2012 or this very new one, which just came out this week in Classical Quantum Gravity. Okay, I have 5 minutes, and I don't have very many slides. So what about, what does this approach do for you before I come to my very last topic, that of quantum observables? Well, it is a demonstration that it is possible in a completely non-perturbative background independent path integral, basically by superposing, morally speaking, objects like this, to obtain, when I'm tuned to a specific part of my phase space spent by my bare coupling constants, to obtain a quantum space-time, that's what we're interested in, that on large scales shares properties familiar from a solution to the classical Einstein equations. And that specific metric, it shares properties, is the de Sitter space. So for a positive cosmological constant, as we do have here in these models. So that's very nice. So it's an example of emergence. And I already said very little tends to emerge, much, much less than we'd ever like to. So there are a bunch of other properties. So as I've already mentioned in passing, the causal structure we put in there seems to be very crucial. There's a non-trivial phase structure. So some of these phases that are emerged, they have these nice emergence properties. We do have second order phase transitions, which other approaches haven't seen. We do have a scale dependent space dimension, et cetera, et cetera. Now, last topic, quantum observables. So we have a crank we turned and a computer that creates kind of a vacuum for us, the vacuum of this particular candidate theory of quantum gravity. So I need to understand what its geometric properties are. And I need to ask the right questions. And what does it mean to ask the right questions? I need to evaluate observables in the sense of measuring their expectation values. Yeah? So what are these? Well, we already know classically that the story of observables is a little bit complicated in gravity. They tend to be very non-local objects. Why is that? Because of the diffeomorphism symmetry requirement. So an observable has to be diffeomorphism invariant. What does it mean in pure gravity? Well, certainly G mean U of X. This is already disqualified because it has a non-trivial index structure. But even a scalar like R of X, X is not an observable because I cannot point to an X, you know, in absence, say, of matter. There's no way for me to point to X. So what I can do, however, is to integrate X with respect to the measures that depends on the metric over all of space-time M. Fine, then I get an observable, but it's very, very coarse-grained. So you can ask, you know, what is it good for? So in the quantum theory, things get worse. Yeah. So I already told you I typically have difficulty to implement or to say what I mean by implementing diffeomorphism invariance, let alone finding nice quantum observables. So I told you that, you know, in CDT, using the ratchet idea, we got rid of the diffeomorphisms. But hey, do I now even know what an observable is, because I characterized it as something invariant under diffeomorphism? So does anything go now in the absence of diffeos? Of course, the answer is no. So to start with, of course, observables, you know, what can I measure on these ratchet geometries? I can measure easily distances, geodesic distances, and volumes. So I can use those. Those will be part of my formulating observables. So they don't necessarily rely on smoothness. One can see that in explicit examples. However, it's exactly like in the continuum that I cannot point to a specific, you know, point or a line or a surface in my triangulated manifold. So I'm really facing the same problems that I faced in the continuum, that a quantity at a point is still not a good quantum observable, and I somehow have to integrate over it. So what form does this take on a triangulation? Well, actually, of course, our computers, our simulations, they all work with label triangulations, because otherwise I just don't know, you know, is this Bob or Alice, or, you know, I give the building names, I give names to the building blocks. But of course, I set up my Monte Carlo simulation such that that is explicitly relabeling invariant. So if you like, I'm putting myself exactly on this quotient space of metric labeled information modulo labeling. And of course, on the level of these quotient spaces, well, this is just a bona fide kind of approximative version of classical geometry modulo diffeomorphisms. So although smooth diffeomorphisms and kind of relabeling of n objects have very little in common as groups, these quotient spaces, I'm working on the assumption that these are kind of closely related, because I'm using them in a crucial way in the quantum theory. So my very last thought, nevertheless, everything is non-local. So how am I possibly getting anywhere just working with these, you know, integrated quantities? Will they give me any interesting information about quantum space-time? And in there comes one additional thought. Yes, they can. Namely, if the thing I'm integrating over in the space-time sense refers to a scale. So in that sense, is itself already a non-local quantity. So this is the form it will take. This here is the ensemble average that I always will be taking to look when I look at quantum observables. And this observable itself, so this depends on some scale, could be a length scale. Here, what I'm integrating over under the trace here is a four-dimensional space-time integral, which I know, well, these are, of course, my typical classical observables, but with the distinction that here I make that observable itself again depend on the scale. So what do I have in mind? So what comes out of this is an observable that on the one hand is definitely a space-time integral, but it has still, it refers to a scale, kind of a scale of a probe. A typical example of this is what we do to extract a Hausdorff dimension from space. So what do we do? At a point in space-time, we look at the volume enclosed in a geodesic ball of radius r. We can do that for single geometry, averaging over all points. But note, it depends then on this r. Yeah? So that is the scale delta that appears in here. If I do that in addition in the ensemble average, I again will get an expression that somehow depends on r. And then when I look at the leading order term and pick out its exponent, that's what I call the Hausdorff dimension. And that Hausdorff dimension, in principle, can also depend on that scale r. So despite the fact here I have a very global observable, I nevertheless have a probe, a scale in there. And the same principle applies to how we extract a spectral dimension, exactly the same principle, and also how we measure quantum Ricci curvature. So that's a new variable that also depends on computing the distance of two spheres, two balls. So nothing but volume and distance measurements enters. And from that, you can extract a nice version of a Ricci tensor, despite the fact that you're not allowed to take derivatives in order to get curvature, because your space-time geometries are not smooth. So you cannot compute the Riemann tensor, but here is a way to extract the Ricci curvature. I don't have time because I have to get to the end of my talk to explain how this goes. So what I have time to is to say, okay, so this is now a quantity, again, that depends on the scale of balls that are given, that are used to discuss what I mean by Ricci curvature at a certain scale delta, linear scale. So I measure this in my quantum ensemble. This could be a very, very wild quantum ensemble. So we've tried it on these two-dimensional quantum gravity models. Yeah. So then I get a curve. That quantity, I plot it as a function of this linear scale, of this length scale delta. And then what I need to do, well, I need to compare it to classical expectations. So in order to be able to say something like, look, in this regime of deltas, of linear distances, this matches very nice a classical expectation. But if I go below, there seem to be some kind of quantum signatures that affect this. And so this is the way I'm trying to understand deviations that might carry an imprint of the quantum theory. So what we're currently doing, we are putting out kind of a reference library where we compute these non-local scale-dependent variables for bunches of classical spaces. So to understand kind of a new, very non-global way to characterize diffeomorphism invariant properties of curved spaces which nevertheless refer to a certain scale. So we're doing this, and it's in general for these Ricci curvature measurements, it's not exactly trivial because you have to understand how the geodesics work on these spaces in the continuum. So, however, that brings me to the end. So I highlighted a few things, as I said in my introduction, I would. So firstly, that finding quantum spacetime is tied to having a sufficiently complete theory of non-perturbative quantum gravity, where these then appear. I then argued for fundamental continuity, as a variant, and maybe simpler thing to do, rather than kind of fundamental discreteness, as a guiding principle. And then I told you and illustrated that this kind of the full power that has gone somewhat underappreciated of this Reggie idea of describing curved geometry without coordinates can be very profitably used in non-perturbative quantum gravity, and in particular, the path integral formulation I used in CDT. So this I used, this specific model, to illustrate all of these points. And they led us also to a new perspective to take on observables. Namely, I highlighted to you kind of what I want to think of as a new class of observers we ought to look at, independent of what our approach is, and that have that are global space-time integrals, but they nevertheless carry a scale dependence that will enable me to pinpoint, hopefully, classical as well as quantum properties. So hopefully all of us will enrich our toolbox to uncover universal properties of quantum spacetime and quantum gravity, also in the Planckian regime, and bring us closer to finding true quantum signatures. So thank you very much.
A bit late, but we have time for very few questions.
Okay, this is an invitation to comment on an attitude. Your approach, to my understanding, has done some important things that we hope some folks will do. You're speaking the language of universality, for instance, just in the kinds of quantum theory. You have phase diagrams, you have scaling properties, a number of observables. So I wonder if you could, when we talk about relationships and various approaches, if we took the most positive, open-minded point of view, is this a kind of invitation to everybody to develop a common language in terms of these universal properties? That's my first thought, that we can use to compare. And my second thought is, do you have tools that might be transferred to SNFO models, to causal sets, to all other models based on background independent path integrals that could help or recommend to all the others in such approaches to reach a discussion on the scaling properties of universal properties?
So the answer to the first question is, I emphasized in passing this need to, I said, in your approach, give me a mechanism that can ensure some degree of uniqueness of whatever you're hoping to get out of that theory. So it's ensured here to some extent by using that standard kind of statistical mechanics toolbox, right? Where if you set up things right, you're almost ensured of universality. I mean, that doesn't mean something interesting has to come out. It's not an insurance of that. But if something interesting comes out, then there is a reasonable degree of uniqueness. So in other approaches, one still needs to address, how do I potentially achieve uniqueness? By what kind of arguments can I say, well, here are only, you know, I only have to adjust, you know, whatever, four parameters or make four arbitrary choices within a certain framework. So that might be a different mechanism from the one I have here, but there are not so many mechanisms that achieve that. So on the second point, I think absolutely. So I tried, of course, to highlight, to take a broader picture. So if you have a, you know, calculation framework where you can address issues of observables, you will find exactly issues also, you know, difficulties one has to deal with in this particular framework. Yeah, so one needs finite quantities, or one needs to renormalize them appropriately, one needs to understand if there are some very wild quantum structures on very short scales, what one means by coarse graining, and implicit in this concept of these scale-dependent observables I talked about at the very end is also some way of, you know, thinking about this coarse graining, which is very tricky in theories of geometry.
I have one fast question. As a criticism to wedge calculus, you mentioned that it doesn't reproduce Liouville gravity in two dimensions.
Right.
So does CDT reproduce Liouville gravity?
No, only DT does. So it turns out, of course, in two dimensions, things are, well, just a little bit more complicated. So it's Euclidean gravity. So Liouville gravity is 2D Euclidean gravity. So there are only two kind of universality class you know of. One is that of DT and Liouville gravity, the other one is that of CDT in two dimensions, which seems is in the same universality class as two-dimensional continuum gravity in a proper time gauge fixing, and also Rojava-Lifshitz, also in 2D. But yeah, of course, there are only two universality class you know of, and I wouldn't take this very seriously as a criticism of Frege calculus, because these two-dimensional models, I mean, they have very little to do with the four-dimensional series. I mean, they have totally different degrees of freedom. So that's definitely not a killer argument. Although it was taken such by, in the old days, in the 80s, when people were studying these models very extensively, also in connection with, you know, non-critical string theory.
Let's thank Renate again.